It's Current State for Friday here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Welcome back. Are you ready for another Detroit documentary? Well, ready or not, here it comes. And singer Michael Bolton is overseeing this project. This actually originates with Michael Bolton. According to a report on MLive, Bolton became so enamored with Detroit recently that he's going to produce a wholly and completely original story never told before about the city. And what Bolton says is, there he is. Michael Bolton's sung a number of Motown songs, I think, and a bunch of classic soul music, so maybe this is his way of paying back the favor, I guess. Bolton says, quote, "What I see in Detroit is this kind of love and loyalty through the best times and the hardest times. And I love seeing that, and I love a comeback story." So the yet-to-be-titled documentary focuses mainly on Dan Gilbert, the business owner and entrepreneur, a quiet guy, I guess, who generally shuns the media, but it'll also feature Aretha Franklin and Smokey Robinson. So, as yet untitled, but coming from Michael Bolton, all about Detroit. We're glad you're here for Friday upcoming. We've got a look at the Silver Bells in the City tonight in downtown Lansing, local memories of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and much more. At the top of our show, Michigan's catalog of administrative rules, thousands of which help regulate safety and professional standards in industries across the state, has gotten thinner lately. The Michigan Office of Regulatory Reinvention, formed 2 years ago by the Snyder administration, has been reevaluating the rules with an eye toward eliminating red tape and invigorating the private sector. On Wednesday, the office announced that more than 1,500 such rules have been scrubbed after being reviewed by committees of stakeholders. MLive's Melissa Anders has been keeping an eye on the process and has filed several stories on it recently, and Melissa's here to tell us more. Nice to see you.
Good to see you, too.
1,500 rules and regulations sounds like a lot, is it?
I think it's significant. The office said that through their process of these advisory committees and such, they've looked at more than 19,000 rules. And after looking at 19,000 rules, they came up with about 1,900 that needed to be rescinded. Well, in that process, some new ones were added, maybe replaced some old ones. So you get a net rule reduction of 1,500, which, given that, I think that sounds significant. Will everybody notice it? Will the state change dramatically? I don't think so.
I think by their very nature, some of these are pretty minuscule and probably they're unenforceable or they're barely noticeable, right?
Oh, definitely. And so in that sense, it's more of a cleaning up of the books, more so than drastically changing the way certain industries work. However, there are some examples where there may be a little bit, you know, bigger changes, and in some cases controversial.
Some number of these changes are stirring little, if any, debate, but a number have been more hotly debated, and we should point out that some of these changes require legislation, not just a rule change, but the legislature needs to swing into action to undo some of these. For example, a series of bills is being considered right now that would eliminate licensing requirements in Michigan for 18 different occupations, and those occupations include dietitians and nutritionists and speech pathologists and landscape architects. It's a long list. What's this about?
So yes, this was one of these, it was an advisory rules committee that looked at the occupational licensing in the state. A lot of occupations require licensing, or if not an actual license, maybe they need to register with the state or have some other requirements. And so they took a look at each one and decided whether or not it was necessary. And in many cases, they decided that the licensing didn't accomplish anything, that maybe there were federal regulations or licensing that did the same thing. And so that's why the state is looking at this. Now, each one, as you said, requires legislation. So there are a host of bills making their way through the legislature right now that would make these changes.
Now, do the arguments for and against sound similar as you move from occupation to occupation? I mean, for removing the regulation and mm-hmm. against removing the reg?
In certain cases, yes. You know, there would be, like you said, with the dietitian and nutritionist or some of these others, the arguments for eliminating it is that there's already, nationwide credentialing services, and that having it done on the statewide level doesn't quite do anything, or maybe that the state really wasn't doing much with this license. In the case of the dietitians, they haven't licensed a single dietitian since they passed the law a few years ago to start licensing them. Or in the case of some other professions, they might keep a list of the landscape architects in the state, but they don't do anything with that list. Okay. So that's the argument for getting rid of it. And then for several of them, the argument for getting rid of or for keeping several of them are also the same, even though they're very different occupations. And mostly that falls along the lines of, you know, the public needs to know that it's seeing a trusted professional in whatever occupation it may be. And that, they also talk about the necessary safety precautions, that knowing that these professionals, whether it's an acupuncturist or, a dietitian or a speech pathologist or even interior designer, has gone through the necessary training to serve the public.
I see another interesting wrinkle here, though, and I noticed this in the dietitian-nutritionist debate, is that eliminating licensing, according to one side anyway, would keep alternative approaches more available. So if you had some kind of cutting-edge alternative that some person may want to try, getting rid of the licensing may keep them on the landscape, on the commercial landscape, whereas requiring licensing might actually remove that option.
And that is the argument on that side. Whether or not that's the case, it's hard to tell. You know, the other side, and really it's the dietitians and nutritionists are who already have that national credentialing. They're the ones who want to keep it. And like you said, it's these folks who work at maybe alternative medicine places or even supplemental, you know, people who sell supplements and vitamins or offer other kind of alternative, medicine offerings, they're worried that, like you said, if there's licensing requirements, that they wouldn't be able to practice. Now, the folks who are trying to get rid of those licensing requirements say that that's not the case. They say that as long as you don't call yourself a dietitian or a nutritionist, that you should be okay to continue doing those sorts of things. It gets real nitty gritty in there, and it's hard to tell at this point.
Another proposal generating a little more heat is a measure that would allow certain electrical work, forgive the pun, generating a little heat, a certain electrical work be done by personnel who are not licensed, quote, electrical contractors. What are the two sides there?
Yes, yeah, so supporters say that other regulations already ensure safety and that the licensing requirements are an unnecessary burden because this is... for a very specific thing. It's in certain manufacturing facilities and mining operations. Employees can work on certain electrical wiring without having that license as long as there's a licensed master electrician employed by this facility.
Okay.
So the supporters say, look, we're already, covering the safety, and this is just a burdensome requirement. But a lot of the unionized electrical workers spoke out against this, saying that removing that requirement of letting people who don't actually have that license do the work can put people at risk, since electrical work can sometimes be dangerous.
We're talking with Melissa Anders of MLive, talking about the work of Michigan's Office of Regulatory Reinvention. They're looking to eliminate a lot of red tape in Michigan's administrative rules. Was there anything resembling a focus to this streamlining, Melissa? I mean, particular departments that have a lot fewer regulations now?
You know, I'm not really familiar with that. I don't know. I haven't been following. You know, the Office of Regulatory Reinvention, as you mentioned, is brand new to the Snyder administration. So I'm not familiar with any sort of thing like this. I'm not saying that there hasn't been, though.
We mentioned the advisory rules committees here briefly earlier. Has anyone complained that the process was not inclusive enough regarding these panels and who sat on the panels? I mean, was industry consulted? Were the regulators, was everybody who was involved really consulted here?
So the advisory rules committees, they did include folks from the industry, folks. So in the case of the environmental one, it included people who are regulated by environmental regulations. So, manufacturers are the big one there.
Mm-hmm.
It included environmental groups and environmental activists, and it included the actual regulators themselves, staff from the state. There have, and in that case, that seemed to be quite an inclusive group, and I have not heard any complaints on that. I do know, I think it was in the liquor law advisory rules committee, there were some complaints about some people that felt they weren't fairly represented. Who specifically it was, there's so many stakeholders in that world of liquor regulations, the wholesalers, the retailers, the manufacturers, and law enforcement. And I think there were some representatives, but there had been some complaints because it's such a hot topic right now that, maybe certain interests weren't represented as well as they should have been.
And the liquor industry is just one industry, and really this organization overlooked all kinds of industries and rules and regulations. You'll occasionally hear of arcane old laws that are still on the books from long ago. Did anything like that surface in this process?
Yeah, one of the rules that it's going to be eliminated in January. So until then, apparently it's still on the books, however unenforceable, that requires childcare workers in Michigan to smile.
Okay, so that one's gone by an idea whose time has come and gone. In other words, yeah, that sounds utterly, utterly unenforceable. As far as the legislative activity that's required to undo some of this, what are the legislative prospects for these bills? Are more likely to pass than fail? Is it a mixed bag? Is it unpredictable?
It's somewhat of a mixed bag, but there has been a lot of momentum lately. Just last week or the week before, the House and Senate both passed several bills relating to these beer, wine, and liquor regulations. Most of them have not made it to Governor Snyder yet, but there seems to be momentum on that. A handful of the occupational deregulation bills have gone through. Out of the 18 occupations they're looking at, some there have not even been bills drafted yet, or at least not introduced. So in that case, it's a mixed bag, but I think some of these do look like they will be going through. So it's so wide-reaching that it's hard to generalize.
Exactly. You stir up an awful lot, I think, when you look at all of these rules. There's thousands and thousands of them. What are you working on today?
Well, today the University of Michigan has a research on quantitative economics, and some of their top economists there come out a few times each year and give updates on how the U.S. and Michigan economy are doing and their forecasts. So I'm interested to hear what they think about how the Michigan economy will be faring in these next few years.
Very good. It's nice to have you here. Melissa Anders reports for MLive. We've been talking about streamlining Michigan's thousands of administrative rules. Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. This week, the Michigan Economic Development Corporation authorized a $3 million loan to Lansing-based NioWave Incorporated. The particle acceleration company will leverage the funds to build a $200 million medical isotope production facility near the Capital Region International Airport. The location is key to Nioh's business strategy. The company wants to export its products to customers around the world, so it's planning its expansion around Port Lansing, the budding international logistics hub that's been sprouting up around the airport the last few years. Nioh is among the first private companies to invest in Port Lansing, and officials are welcoming the trend. Current State's Kevin Lavery reports.
Nioh's decision to build a new radiopharmaceutical facility near the Capital Region International Airport isn't just a potential boon to the local economy. It's a carefully calculated attempt to break into a market in which the United States lags behind. Jerry Hollister is Nioh's chief operating officer. He says radiopharmaceuticals are a $3 billion annual industry in this country. Yet most of those products are made in Europe and Canada.
So the U.S. is a net importer right now, and we're poised to now transform that, turn around, bring jobs to mid-Michigan, and then be an exporter for radiopharmaceuticals.
Hollister says the Lansing region is primed to be a global leader in this field. He cites the technical know-how that exists at the Cyclotron Superconductivity Lab at Michigan State University and the upcoming facility for rare isotope beams now under construction on campus.
Between those two projects and our project, there's a significant accelerator industry here in mid-Michigan, really, that's unrivaled around the world. And so both for the accelerator industry and for Port Lansing, we believe it's a very exciting and economically stimulating project.
Hollister says Nioh's production lab will eventually employ up to 120 people. Groundbreaking is expected next spring. Radioisotopes eventually decay, so they have a limited shelf life. That's another reason why Nioh is building at the airport, to move product quickly from R&D to the runway. The Port Lansing cargo warehouse sits about 200 feet from Gate 11 at the airport. The 48,000-square-foot building is less than a year old, and so far it has three tenants. Two of them are 3PLs, or third-party logistics providers that manage supply chains around the world. Brent Case is the former director of international trade development for the Lansing Regional Chamber of Commerce. He says marketing Lansing to prospective companies used to be a lot harder before the 3PLs arrived, back when it was just him and the airport authority giving their elevator pitch.
Encouraging them to think about Lansing, but not having really the tools or the assets in place for them to take advantage of the foreign trade zone and the global logistics hub that we're sitting in right now.
Case now works for one of those 3PLs, Indianapolis-based TOC Logistics. TOC set up shop here in September. It was attracted in part to Lansing's status as a foreign trade zone, a place designed to reduce the costs of importing and exporting. Greg Scavel is director of global development for TOC. He says instead of dealing with the cargo backlog inherent to large freight hubs like Detroit and Chicago, TOC enjoys a faster and more cooperative relationship with customs and border protection agents in Lansing.
There are opportunities for us to bring the product before it's cleared to Lansing, and the CBP officers here are very excited to have this business, and they give it priority attention. Attention and time is huge in our industry, and if you're getting the attention, then you're getting things done efficiently.
Inside the warehouse, Brent Case points to a row of shelves containing various chemicals and rolls of brightly colored tape.
The chemicals are used right here in the Lansing area, and the tape is distributed all over the country.
What's so special about this tape? Port Lansing's third tenant, Executive Fan, makes a variety of tapes adorned with sports team logos. Fan tape, they call it. It's a prime example of a value-added commercial process. Adhesive tape is flown in from China, Executive Fan adds its own sporty flair, and then sells it across the U.S. But the advantage here is that Executive Fan pays no duties or tariffs on the tape when it first arrives. That happens after it leaves the Lansing Foreign Trade Zone. Case says that helps American companies better manage their bottom lines.
So it helps with cash flow. Ultimately, the duty is all paid on this, but it just doesn't have to be paid at the time the container hits the seaport all at once. It's paid in small increments.
Now, you might be thinking that with the holidays fast approaching, there'd be a huge global demand for packing tape. Greg Scavel says that model used to hold true, but simply look around your neighborhood stores the day after Halloween, and you'll find Christmas cargo arrives much sooner than Santa does. Scavel says in just the last 5 years, market demand has pushed the international supply chain system into high holiday gear as early as April or May. The global economy also means freight logistics companies don't have to physically be in any particular location to oversee the flow of goods into it. Scavel says having a branch office in Lansing helps TOC Logistics customers feel more hands-on.
They're not talking to somebody in Texas and expecting that person in Texas to understand the geography of the area, just the simple traffic of the area, how to get from point A to point B, how long does it take to get there. And so the local decision makers, the local businesses here in this 8-county region, they're just going to be more comfortable.
Port Lansing is still very much in development. Brent Kay says officials are talking with the Michigan Economic Development Corporation about building an intermodal rail hub that might be built near the airport and possibly a new commercial district off U.S. 127. Case believes Port Lansing is on the cusp of achieving all the goals its planners set forth.
Now we have the attention and investment by the private sector, which really confirms that the concept that we had is viable. And so now we are bringing in the cargo, and I guess the rest will follow.
And with the news of NioWave's high-profile expansion, the pace may already be set for more companies to start landing in Lansing. For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. One sophomore at Michigan State University has spent the last 2 weeks in Peru on an extraordinary expedition through rainforests and mountains with the organization Impossible to Possible. Journalism major Abby Newton was selected as one of four youth ambassadors from all over the world to participate in this mission, where she, along with her other team members, ran a marathon a day for 6 days while working to inspire young kids in Peru to reach beyond their perceived limits. Abby Newton joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Current State. Welcome back to the United States.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
You were there 2 weeks. You've been back how long?
Since Sunday night. So I finally recovered, I think.
Okay. Took a few days, though, did it?
It did.
What was it? Describe the aim of this adventure exactly.
So like you said, the organization is Impossible to Possible. And our whole mission is to inspire young kids by challenging ourselves mentally and physically. But we go beyond that, and we also look at kids across the globe, not just in Peru. So kids could subscribe to what we're doing, and we constantly upload video, we constantly upload footage to kind of demonstrate what we're doing. So we had about 10,000 kids subscribe to this project. And in addition, we supply them with an educational curriculum. So this time we looked at ecosystems. So we ran through 8 different ecosystems in Peru, and through that we looked at the human impact, the human service it provides, and we developed a curriculum that classrooms and teachers used to teach kids about ecosystems and build that awareness. Yeah. So anything from rainforests to gold mining to coca fields to mountains to oxygen to trees, it was a wide spectrum.
All the while running about 25 miles a day. This is what I call multitasking.
We tried our best. We tried our best.
How did you endure the 150 miles total, close to a marathon a day? Talk to us about that.
Sure. You know, it was difficult, but we've been training for about 3 months. And so with that training, we've built up to running about 3 hours at a time. And so during the day, we'd wake up about 5 or 6 a.m. And then we started our run about 8 a.m. And we ran from about 8 to 11:30 or 12. And then at 12, we had lunch. And we also video conferenced all the classrooms who were following us. So we talked about what we experienced during the day. We talked about how our body was feeling, as well as how we were doing mentally, focusing on this run. And then we'd have lunch, relax for a little bit, engage with some communities, and then about 2 we started running again until about 6 p.m.
And then and remind us again who was participating in the video conference. These were young people all over the world.
All over the world, yes. So anywhere from Grand Rapids to Canada to, you know, my hometown to Australia, all over the world. So
I can't imagine the last couple of days though, waking up at 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning knowing that another 25 miles lay ahead of you. I mean, mentally that was That sounds really, really demanding, even for a young person like yourself.
It was, but you know, in our interview process, our the founder asked us, okay, it's day four. You just finished running 3 marathons. Why in the world are you going to wake up on day four and get out of your tent? So my answer to that was because I can, because I've got 2 legs, I've got 2 arms, I've got a head on my shoulders. Let's do it for those who can't. So I think that was my whole aim is, you know what, why not? We can do it, so let's see if our bodies can do it so we can inspire others to maybe take their math test or run a mile or just do something better than themselves.
And you presumably had hundreds or thousands of young people watching you go through this ordeal who were presumably hopefully inspired by what you were doing, that they could do the same thing.
Think
big, that kind of thing. And you spent a lot of time in one of the most biodiverse ecosystems in the world, Manu National Park in Peru. I take it, so studying biodiversity specifically was part of the experience.
Absolutely.
And tell us about that. Sure. How did you experience all of this biodiversity?
You know, coming in, I was more focused on the running because you're focused on this training for 3 months. It's constantly in your head. But then after you experience this, you realize, you know, the running was very important. But during the running, I was thinking about the biodiversity. I was thinking about the culture. I was thinking about Peru. So that really occupied my mind. And almost it felt like my time. So I think we learned a lot about the importance of biodiversity. For instance, we went to a village and we talked about potatoes. So in Peru, there's over 300 species of potatoes. But in the last 4 years, 30 of those species have declined. And so it was really interesting in how, you know, climate change and how different things are affecting Peru as well as different countries around the world in biodiversity. So it's really interesting. We met a woman who has now a potato museum because she's trying to preserve this biodiversity. So she was a fantastic woman. She spoke Spanish, so we were able to communicate with her a little bit. And she has all these potatoes. You know, in America, we have these 2 giant potatoes we can choose from in the supermarket. But in Peru, they've got hundreds. So it's little things like that that really open your eyes to the importance of preserving the world around us.
And you put in so many miles that you must have, did you run through, you were out in the country, you were in Cusco, I saw at one point, so you ran the gamut, basically.
Right.
You were in all kinds of different settings, basically. What was the biggest challenge of all?
The biggest challenge, I think it comes to 2 parts. So day 6 was difficult. I think after you've run about 125 miles, you're feeling a little sore, you're feeling a little tired. You're just ready to kind of sit down and have a giant meal and say, "Woo, we did it."
Yeah.
But day 6 was difficult because we were all in the rainforest. So for 7 hours straight, we were running in the rainforest. We packed our own lunches, like random cookies and food and mangoes, just to eat along the way. But it was kind of tough because it was a trail run. So your body felt it. Every step, you know, you're going up straight hills, you're going up, you're climbing hands and knees trying to get places, and all the while it's covered, so you're feeling a little claustrophobic, just kind of feeling, get me out, I'm ready to go. So that was a big challenge. But in addition, one of the most memorable parts of the trip, I think, was going to a school. So we went to a school in Peru who weren't very well off, and we brought them school supplies. So we presented them with these school supplies, and just their response was amazing. I mean, they were so happy, and there was a little girl who wrote a poem to us, and it was in Spanish, but some of us spoke Spanish, so we could understand it. And she said, you know, the pencil, it will run out. The ink, it will run out. But the message of anything is possible with hard work will stay forever. So that moment, just emotions ran over us. We were so overwhelmed and enthralled with what we were doing. And that was at 6 a.m. that morning. So then we went and we ran 25 miles. So just thinking about that and that emotional, you know, exhaustion you just felt during that whole day. But then it gave you more value to run because you're running for these kids. You're running for that message.
Mm. Very impressive. And you've got an altitude situation to deal with in Peru that you do not have to deal with in East Lansing. What was that like?
You know, it's tough. In training, they said, okay, go find hills, go find mountains, run them. I said, oh, where the heck am I going to find that in the Midwest? But when we got there, we had a couple days to adjust, but you're exhausted. I mean, it's amazing how much the altitude takes out of you. Even sleeping, you feel like you can't breathe fully, so it's a little frightening. But we adjusted for a couple days. Day one was pretty tough because we were at 12,000 feet to start, and we were actually in a cloud forest. So we were in the clouds running 25 miles. So our bodies definitely felt it. But once you kind of gritted your teeth and ran, you got over it pretty quickly.
We're talking with Abby Newton. Abby's a sophomore at Michigan State University who spent the last 2 weeks in Peru on an extraordinary teaching expedition. She shared her experience with students in online conferences all over the world and learned about biodiversity while she was down there. So she got an awful lot done in a couple of weeks. Do you feel this changed you?
I do.
And if so, how?
I do. You know, people say a lot, oh, that was a life-changing experience. But I think, you know, going in, you're looking for that moment. You're looking for that epiphany moment in which you say, boom, aha, got it. But that doesn't come. It's more the reflections afterwards that really help you understand how it is a life-changing moment. And so I think, you know, being immersed in this culture and being immersed in so many different perspectives, I realized two things. One, we've got a lot of stuff in America. And I think I want to live a little bit more simply and really focus and appreciate the little things in life, not necessarily the material things in life. And two, I realized the importance of understanding different people's perspectives. You know, at one point I was at a restaurant and a man voiced his dissatisfaction with America. You know, he was saying very rude things, and that was the first time I'd experienced that. And so it was very interesting, but I, you know, sat there, I said, okay, it's important that we understand these different perspectives to really build this understanding of the world around us. Mm-hmm. And so engaging in communication with a lot of the locals, a lot of the people in gold mines, you know, in coca fields, all different lives than I've ever thought about or experienced, was a huge, huge growing point for me, and something that I constantly want to draw back to and constantly realize the importance of listening and understanding the world around you. So I,
What kind of things did the young people who participated in the teleconferencing, mm-hmm. what kind of things did they say? How did they respond?
They had a lot of questions. So they had a lot of questions across the board. One, you know, why are you doing this? What is it like running through Peru? Who are the people you're meeting? A lot of the kids really wanted to understand how little kids live in Peru. So that was really interesting, as they said, you know, what are the little kids doing, kids our age, or how do people make a living? So I think, you know, more than anything, these kids really, really wanted to understand what it's like to live in another country, because they've never experienced that. Mm-hmm. So that was interesting.
How are you tempted to set the bar higher? I mean, you surmounted a really significant physical and educational mm-hmm. challenge here, all wrapped up in one. Are you tempted to tackle something else equally as dramatic in the future?
I think not equally more dramatic. I mean, I think that's what life's about. It's constantly challenging yourself. It's constantly pushing beyond the next thing. And so whether it's 160 miles or whether it's in a completely different realm, I think it's so important to continually challenge yourself. And so absolutely, I'm looking for the next thing. And more than anything, I don't want to go to these different experiences just to absorb. I want to go to apply. So I want to take what I'm learning and apply it to the world around me, see how I can make the change, see how I can enhance myself now to enhance the society around me in the future.
Did anybody get injured? I have to ask you that.
Actually, one girl got tendonitis in her feet. And so she showed up, and she's from Canada, so she's used to running in the mountains. But she showed up with the foot socks. You know, they're not real shoes, they're foot socks. So she showed up. We go, oh, my gosh, you crazy. But she ends up getting tendonitis about day four. So she ran through a couple days, but she had to take a few times off just to kind of rest. So that was difficult, and it definitely pushed the boundaries of the team, you know.
I imagine there's a way that our listeners can maybe visually share this experience. Mm-hmm. Is there a website you can direct them to?
Yes. If you go to impossible2possible.org, you can link up to the Peru expedition as well as all the other expeditions the organization does.
And that's the numeral 2, by the way.
Yes.
impossible2possible.org. Abby Newton is a sophomore at Michigan State University studying journalism. She's been talking about a tremendous adventure in Peru that's just wrapped up over the course of 2 weeks. Abby, thank you so much for sharing your story. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
The Michigan State University Opera Theater is presenting Mozart's The Magic Flute starting tonight in the newly renovated Fairchild Theater. The vocalists are directed by MSU Professor of Voice Melanie Helton, and MSU Director of Orchestras Kevin Noe leads the orchestra. Current State's Melissa Benmark talked with Noe about his first time leading The Magic Flute.
There are some conducting challenges. Physically, it's just the hardest thing we ever do. I mean, a Mahler symphony is much more straightforward in many ways than conducting an opera. But I think the real challenge is marrying theater and music. That's the challenge. How do you get the intention of the words to be impeccably clear, not just from a diction standpoint, which is difficult always, but from an intention standpoint? How do you get the words driving things? How do you get the musicians in the pit hanging on those words and then shaping things by intention, by narrative, rather than simply shaping musically? You know what I mean? I think that's what's really hard. That's the challenge. That's where I spend most of my time. That's where the great joys of opera conducting come, and that's where the great heartaches come, when you can't seem to blend those two.
Did the instrumentalists have to keep kind of an eye on stage as well as on you?
Well, in order to stay together, they don't necessarily have to keep an eye on stage, but they have to keep a profound sense of awareness of what's going on stage. Now, I hate to say this, but in many systems of putting together a pit orchestra plus the cast on the stage, there's so little emphasis placed on the people in the pit knowing what's going on, it puts them in a very kind of disabled position to connect with the people on stage. But we spend a lot of time, I mean, everybody in the orchestra knows the story, they know what every aria is about, so they know what we're trying to accomplish. And in many cases, I've had them write in words underneath what they're playing so that they know not only what the intention is, but the length. You know, they, if somebody says, "I love you," and you see three quarter notes, then you can play pom, pom, pom. You know, you have that sort of "I love you" tension and release that is such the foundation of Western music and Mozart in particular. So I think that stuff is essential, and that's the good stuff. But again, it's an enormous task because you've got, you know, my score is 400 pages. So you've got, it's just a lot to ask, you know. The musicians in the orchestra, the violin section, the poor violin section has, I would love to count the number of notes in Magic Flute. I shudder to even imagine 20,000 or more, probably. I wouldn't doubt it, you know. And each one of them is part of some connected thing, something with intention, you know. You try coming up with 20,000 perfectly in tune and together intentions that are shaped by a narrative, you know. It's tough stuff.
What is it about this opera that makes people say, okay, if you've never seen an opera before and you want to start out, see the Magic Flute? Why do you think that is?
That's a good question. You know, this is my first time with flute, so maybe it is because it is so, I don't know if malleable is the right word, but it's such a universal subject, and it can be seen in so many different ways. It is the type of opera that, depending on the way the director chooses to emphasize certain themes or other themes, it can take a new shape each time. And those themes, that plethora of themes is so universal that, again, depending on how that's handled, you may find certain aspects of it really apply to you easily. You know, David Mamet, the great playwright and director, he's saying, you know, great writing is not telling you exactly every little specific thing that is happening. Great writing is hooking you into believing that you are, in fact, the protagonist, you know. So if you say, for example, a man went into the forest in search of a girl, and it's a man hearing this story, he immediately thinks he is heading into the forest in search of this girl. But if you say, a man in his early 20s, with a twinkle in his eye and wonderful blonde locks of hair, went off in search of a dark maiden, but all of a sudden you think, well, that's some other guy, and that couldn't possibly have anything to do with me. And the art is dancing that line of where it's descriptive enough that it's plausible, but it still makes you believe that you are, in fact, participating, you know. And I think Magic Flute has that framework to it. It's general enough that you can cast yourself into it, you know, and it's specific enough to keep you engaged and compelled, you know. I think that's probably it. And, of course, the music is not shabby. Yeah.
Do you find a particular part that to you is sort of the most charming or moving to be directing? I know it's hard to pick in something of that length, but...
You mean within the opera itself, within Magic Flute? There are an awful lot of really touching things. I mean, the Tamino and Pamina final or first kiss, I guess, the final arrival, which is their kiss, is such a nice moment when they finally come together. That's a beautiful thing. I I think little subtle things in opera are the things that really interest me, one relationship of one character to the next. I think the particular way that Papageno and Tamino relate to each other, not just their own threads as they go forward. Tamino is on this great search to find his love, which is Pamina, and Papageno, in a much more roundabout and somewhat more cowardly way, is on, you know, on a search for Papageno, his love interest. They go about it in such different ways, but on the way they collide into each other in this really interesting way, and there's this sort of like a odd couple relationship between the two of them. I think that's really fascinating, you know. I think the backstory about what may have happened that drove a wedge between Zarastro and the Queen of the Night is fascinating. You know, here the whole story, all the action, all the plot is driven by this some type of feud between the two of them over whatever it is, and yet we never see the two of them on stage together. They never come together and sort of like, you know, butt heads or anything. They just obviously had something happen between the two of them, whatever it is. The queen says it's that Zarastro gave the circle of the sun and this and that and the other. But, you know, I always had this feeling that maybe she wasn't all giving the whole truth about things, you know, and that their relationship in the past may have been something more than what they're telling anybody else, you know. So, I don't know, the backstory there is quite fascinating. You know, for me, it's always about the relationship of the characters. And if you can embed the music within that in a really special kind of way, what you wind up doing in opera, and this is my favorite kind of opera, and I recognize I'm in the minority on this, is that I forget they're singing. That's when I'm really in. Of course, there are singing, and if you ask me, I would say, I guess they're singing. But when I lose track of that and I'm not marveling at the vocal apparatus and the pipes and I'm following that story and I'm following the connection and it's heightened in a way that only music could ever bring that level of intensity, that's when I'm in real opera for me.
Kevin Noe, thank you very much for joining us. For Current State, I'm Melissa Van Mark.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. 50 years ago today, President John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, Texas. Current State Scott Pohl joins us with a remembrance. Good morning, Scott.
Hi, Mark.
Let's make it official here. Where were you 11/22/63?
I was a second grader at Bath Mills Elementary, which was a one-room schoolhouse between Albion and Concord in southern Michigan.
Oh, boy.
And I honestly, at that age, my recollection is more of the weekend than of that particular day. I don't remember, frankly, if we were sent home from school early like some schools did or that sort of detail about that day.
Well, it triggers
an
indelible series of memories for many millions of Americans, and for baby boomers like us, it invariably reconnects us to elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have occasion to think about elementary school an awful lot, but on November 22nd, you always do. I was dutifully sitting in Mrs. DeWitt's fifth grade classroom in Ovid, and our principal's voice interrupted the activities over the address system, which rarely happened. So it got everybody's attention, and he delivered the news. And like you, I remember very little of what happened after that, just a room of 10-year-olds trying to digest what they had just heard. But I remember, as you, I remember more of what happened over the weekend, really, black and white images flickering on the TV set, and Walter Cronkite's voice indelibly etched in my brain, and drum cadences, and the Kennedy family. So that was basically it. You wanted to collect stories from local people about where they were on November 22nd of 63. Where did you go?
Well, I had this idea to find people with vivid memories of that day, and I decided to go to the Primetime Senior Center at the Hanna Community Center in East Lansing. I was lucky enough to find some great stories at a memoirs writing class they're holding there, and WKAR music host Jody Noel also helped me find some audio from the Kennedy funeral. Let's listen.
Oh, I'm Sharon French. I live in Haslett, Michigan now. At the time of Kennedy's assassination, I lived in Kalamazoo. I was a student at Milam Junior High School in ninth grade, and my art teacher, Mrs. Sturdivant, announced to our class that he had been killed. I think the most shocking thing about it was that we all regarded her as a cold fish, sort of strict kind of teacher, and we were all shocked that she was crying and could hardly get the words out about the fact that he had been killed.
I'm Helen Higgins, and I live in East Lansing. I was a senior in high school when Kennedy was shot, and was living in Allen Park, Michigan, which is downriver in the Detroit area. I was actually in the car with my mother because I had been having a problem with my wrist, and we were driving to the public health hospital in Grosse Pointe because my dad was in the Army, and that's where we got our medical care. And we heard something on the radio, and we just sort of thought, well, that's funny, that must be some other country. And then when we got there, and I remember it so clearly, there was a round sort of bench in the middle of the waiting room, and the nurse came out and announced that Kennedy had died. And we were all just kind of stunned. We didn't know what to do at that point, so we just carried on. This was a military hospital, so no, we're rather stoic. We're taught to be stoic in these events. And I don't remember any crying, but I also don't remember any talking. I remember silence. And it was a big room full of people, and that everybody was just silent.
My name is Kate Murphy. I currently live in Pinckney. And November 22nd, 1963, I was a sophomore at Marquette University in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And it was a Friday morning. I remember I slept in. I either had been partying the night before or I studied hard the night before. So it was around 11 o'clock. My roommate came into the room and she was crying. And she said President Kennedy was shot. And shortly after that, we found out that he had died. And it was interesting because Marquette is a Catholic university, a Jesuit university. All of a sudden, there were just streams of students walking to our Jesu church. And we all went, and everybody's crying, of course. Everybody went to Jesu church. And all of a sudden, a priest appeared on the altar, and there was a mass said.
My name is Tom Ryan. I live in Bath, Michigan. And at the time of Kennedy's assassination, I was a junior high school teacher in Grosse Pointe, Michigan. It was my first full-time teaching job. And I recall that I was in the library with a group of eighth graders doing research on a project that asked the question, why did America become America? And all of a sudden, the loudspeaker came on, which really irritated me. I'll never forget how angry I got because it was the principal. And essentially, he simply asked everybody to go back to their homerooms. And so we did and went downstairs. And then he made the formal announcement about the news that the president had been shot and was at the Parkland Hospital in Dallas. And so there was, as you might imagine, with the eighth graders, a lot of angst and anguish, a lot of tears. And as a young teacher, I wasn't quite sure how to handle the situation as well, but we did muddle through. We talked about what we'd been studying, America and the presidency, and we emphasized at that time that we didn't know whether the president was alive or dead, but that we would pray for him. And the rest of the day was very, very quiet in that junior high school, which was very atypical for a junior high.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. We're glad you could join us here on 90.5 WKAR. Current State Weekend is up tomorrow and on Sunday. We return on Monday. And on this weekend before Thanksgiving, Lansing is again preparing to host its largest public outdoor event of the year. This is the 29th year for Silver Bells in the City, which features music, crafts, and the Electric Light Parade through the city's downtown. A reminder that WKAR-TV will be presenting the parade live starting at 6 p.m. But there's a lot of work to be done before tonight's festivities. Current State's Kevin Lavery spent a couple of days wandering through town talking with people setting up for the event. He first met Dave Hoover atop a cherry picker in front of the State Capitol building. Dave was rigging Christmas lights for tonight's official lighting, but just how many? He wasn't exactly sure.
Oh, I couldn't tell you. We go by the spool. What we got, like 200 lights on a spool? About 200 lights on a spool. We've been through two or three of them already. Yeah, we've been at this all day. We're going to have it ready for the night. Hopefully it'll be beautiful by the time it's lit up.
I'm Pam Latka at CATA Marketing Assistant. The CATA bus float is a 60-foot articulated bus that we've converted into a Caterpillar, which is representative of CATA's buses that you see out on the streets. The Caterpillar is definitely a very popular crowd pleaser, and they can see it coming down the road because the antennas are so high, and the bounce of the antennas and the anticipation of, oh, here comes the Caterpillar, resonates around the crowd, as we're told.
Hi, I'm Heather Himes. I'm the manager of the Lansing City Market. We have our Christmas tree, and right next to that we'll have three different music acts playing tonight, starting about 5 o'clock until 9 o'clock. So we'll be playing some Christmas tunes and some other songs, too, to kind of brighten everybody's holiday spirit tonight.
My name's Bob Perialis.
And you have been with Board of Water and Light how long?
About 11 years.
We're looking at the float that represents kind of the newer, more modern Board of Water and Light. What are we looking at here, Bob?
The biggest feature of the float is our four wind turbines on here, which really represents the future and green energy that we have. I won't be riding this year, but we'll have lots of our BWL families, mainly on our historic Skyline float.
So the duct tape guy does not get the pleasure of being chauffeured?
No,